Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Larry Massett. According to Plato, we all live in a cave, so to speak. In this cave, there is not much light. It seems to come from somewhere behind us or overhead, we don't know. It is, perhaps, the sun, but we don't know that either. All we know are the shadows we see flickering on the sides of our cave. The shadows are, of course, insubstantial. They are rather far from actual things, but since we don't know any better, we take them for the truth. If you care to sign up for the full course, Dr. Plato promises to lead you outside the cave, steer you towards the really real things, and even show you the sun. Evidently, Plato didn't think much of caves. E.M. Forster, on the other hand, made a cave the hero of his great novel, A Passage to India. It is in the caves at Elephanta, you may recall, that the heroine has a blinding mystical insight into the ultimate nature of reality, an insight she cannot bear to understand. The cave we are going to bring you today is nothing so grand. It will not explain the meaning of life one little bit. It will only, perhaps, tell us where we came from. As you know, we are all immigrants here in America. Geologists say that during the Ice Age there was a bridge of land between Asia and western Alaska. Our first settlers walked over, so it is said, and then, about 10,000 years ago, as the ice began to melt and the bridge disappeared, the people who had settled in Alaska turned south into the rest of the continent. Naturally, there is archaeological evidence for this theory, but there are other ideas as well. Today, producers Lisa Bush and Robert Woolsey take us to Prince of Wales Island on the coast of southeast Alaska. Here, a system of caves recently discovered may be opening a window for us, a dark, damp window through which we will try to peer back into the Ice Age.
When you're hanging in the middle of a 600-foot rope with 300 feet of black below you and 300 feet of black above you, it's a little bit intimidating.
Intimidating?
Intimidating.
Or scary.
Intimidating.
On rope!
Okay, on the way.
Okay. Okay, this goes on the rope like this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm putting that down so it's gripping the rope, see?
Right.
Downward pressure.
Wait, but doesn't this go on the other side of me? Doesn't I go like this with this?
Doesn't matter.
This is El Capitan, the largest cave in Alaska. There are no colored lights in here, no gift shop outside, no ranger giving tours. This is a dark, muddy place, and exploring it is a little like rock climbing in a refrigerator. But identifying this and nearby caves and mapping their passages is the jumping-off point for what may be the greatest leap of faith for North American archaeology to date, the idea that sophisticated, maritime people lived and moved along Alaskan shores during the Ice Age.
Okay, I think we're just going to take a little rest here. I think I'm about halfway on this rocky cliff. Would you call this a cliff? And I'm sort of slowly lifting myself up using these ascenders on the rope, and then I can kind of sit back in this harness. It's kind of a pretty cool way to get around, but I see it sort of requires quite a bit of practice.
I'm a science writer in the company of cavers. I have no love of damp, dark places, but here, nearly 2 miles inside a mountain, I'm convinced that finding out about ancient cave people rests on the shoulders of modern cave people, the people who go into unexplored places with rope, helmets, and headlamps, and painstakingly map the dark passages of these Alaskan caves. El Capitan Cave was mapped in 1988, but it wasn't until 1990 that a geologist realized that this cave was part of a huge system of possibly thousands of caves, nearly all of which were formed before the Ice Age. After some initial exploration and some major paleontological findings were made, the geologist packed a slide projector and took his news on the road.
Well, thank you, Larry. I really appreciate the opportunity to share this information with you folks. I want to really thank the Conservation Council and the Sitka Ranger District who got me up here. Alaska holds her secrets pretty well.
Jim Baichtal is a geologist for the United States Forest Service in southeast Alaska. His district includes Prince of Wales, an island the size of Delaware, with steep mountains covered with prime timber. A walking brick from Texas A&M, with a bushy beard and a big NRA belt buckle, Baichtal looks like the quintessential mountain man. Geology is a specialty, but he's a broad scientific thinker. When skeletons of black bears that lived 10,000 years ago were found in these caves, Baichtal reasoned if the climate were warm enough for bears, chances are pretty good big chunks of the coast were not covered with ice. The archaeologists take it from there. They say if bears were living here, humans could have been here too, island hopping on their way south.
I believe that we were not overridden by a blanket of ice, as some of the textbooks have been telling us for years. I think we had a lot of open areas along the coast, enough open areas that animals and man could have migrated south. These bears, roughly 10,000 years ago, got to Prince of Wales Island. I don't believe the only single first bear that got to Prince of Wales went over and died in that cave. The sea level, 20,000 years ago, was 300 feet less than it is today. If early man migrated then, we're not going to find those sites without diving for them. But if any of those parties went inland hunting or went through a saddle to cross over from one isthmus to another, and spent the night in one of the caves that already existed, then the chances of answering some of those questions of that migration of man and early animals and stuff south, this is the resource we're going to find it in, because if it can get into the caves, the preservation is almost guaranteed.
The Forest Service is a resource management agency. They use the word resource to characterize most everything they deal with. To explore this newly found cave resource and develop it not only as an archaeological resource, but also as a biological, hydrological, and geological resource, Jim Baichtal needed people, a human resource. With the blessing of the Forest Service, he's installed a group of volunteer cavers at a remote operations center on the island. El Capitan Camp sits on a gravel spur road, a government trailer court in the middle of an enormous wilderness. The government foresters, who also live here, are preparing tracts of timber for sale. El Capitan is near the heart of the largest logging operation on public lands in the nation. It's a busy place, a working island.
Come around a corner and I heard scree, scree, and I looked and two cubs appeared going up a tree right smack in front of me, and Mom was like, woof! She rears up, you know, and was like, okay, cool, if you don't like, you can have them. I don't want them.
What am I doing here? Oh, I grew up listening to tales of Alaska from my grandfather. Had to come out and find out what it was all about. I don't know, it's a great land. There's so many questions out here that's unanswered. It's virtually wide open as far as geology and paleontology and those kind of things. I moved up here in 1990, and I was going to be the liaison between the workings at Quartz Hill Molybdenum Mine and the Forest Service over in Mystic Fjords National Monument. That was going to be the largest portion of my job. And somebody had said once in passing that there's a few caves up here, and they kind of ran their finger around on a map about this area and said that one day you ought to look at it. And so I'd been here about 2 or 3 months and grabbed air photographs one day before I went out in the field up here, and immediately saw there was no streams and several hundred sinkholes on the plateau up here and several cave entrances and resurging streams down by the lakes, and realized that this was a major karst area up here.
Karst is how geologists usually refer to an area with a lot of caves. It's dominated by porous rock, limestone for the most part. When water flows through karst, it carves huge channels and sinkholes, like when you pour hot water over a stack of sugar cubes. Karst occurs all over the world, but no one expected to find it so far north. Alaska is supposed to be all glaciers and tundra, but down along the southeastern coast, Alaska is rainforest. Unlike other drier karst areas, here the rain is still carving new caves. These unique conditions both excite and worry Jim Baichtal. If the archaeology of this area is to be realized, the Forest Service may have to change its management style so the karst formations are preserved.
I wanted to ask you about yourself and about your mission, if you feel like you're a man with a mission, and what that is.
A mission. I hope to get the resource that's here realized how important it is, and the key it could hold, especially to the prehistory of Southeast, with the bone deposits we're finding in all these caves and the preservation of those bones and the associated cultural deposits. I think looking at how animals and man migrated southward, there's going to be some really key stuff come out of the cave here. Some very important discoveries.
Do you like working for the Forest Service?
I love it.
How do you think the Forest Service views you?
Oh, I don't know. Boy, that's a tough one.
Jim Baichtal may have to tell his boss, the U.S. Forest Service, that it's shooting itself in the foot by harvesting timber in cave areas. The caves are the plumbing for this towering rainforest, where it rains 150 inches a year. Timber operations, namely clear-cutting and road-building, affect the drainage by eroding the paper-thin topsoil and clogging the caves with sediment. Baichtal believes traditional forest management won't work on karst, because if you wash away the topsoil, the big trees may never grow back. While a battle between caves and timber looms like a storm front, cavers like Marcel and Connie LaPierre press on with their underground surveys, hard work made harder by the growing controversy.
Down in these holes, they're cold. Most of them are 38 degrees. They're often very muddy, and they're wet. They're very wet.
When you go into a cave, usually you rappel down into it. You're stuck if you
right.
don't know how to get out, up the rope and on the rope and not on the rock. Sometimes they're free rappels. You're rappelling and you're not touching any rock.
Right.
You're just hanging on the rope. If you don't know how to get up the rope, you're stuck.
I've heard that there's some tension between the cavers and the loggers.
It's unfortunate that there can't be some meeting of the minds here. You know, we don't have anything against the loggers. We don't have anything against the logging companies or the Forest Service. We're just asking that they use a little bit of common sense and protect some of our resources, including above ground and below ground, for future generations.
There is a law that protects caves. The Federal Cave Resources Protection Act has teeth. It can close down logging around significant caves. Mapping is the first step in determining how significant a cave is. But until the cavers began their work, the Forest Service didn't pay much attention to the law when deciding what timber to sell for logging. As a result, unexplored caves were destroyed because they were never identified. As the logging proceeds at a rapid pace, cavers like Rob Knotts feel tremendous pressure to stay one step ahead of the chainsaw, mapping as many caves as they can.
Why should someone care about a cave?
I don't know.
I mean,
without these caves, you'd have never had the hydrology that produced these trees in the first place. And so that's one aspect, and I'm not even a smart person, but I can see those things, you know? Yeah, I never even finished high school, for crying out loud, and it's obvious to me.
Do you, when you're out caving, do you hear the chainsaws and the loggers in action?
Well, that's kind of a silly question, because there's really nowhere you can go on the island that you don't. I mean, there's no place you can go that you don't hear the cutters and the fallers out there. Everywhere you hear that.
Above ground, the controversy over the caves is hard to escape. But so far, the archaeologists have been only spectators in the environmental struggle, saving their strength for the academic one. Scientists who spent their career establishing the theory of inland migration are not exactly flocking to the coast. Portraying early humans as mariners requires a certain amount of faith, faith that early Americans had the savvy to build seaworthy boats. James Dixon, an archaeologist from the University of Alaska, feels coastal people would have had a radically different lifestyle than inland hunters.
I think that if you're hunting large mammals, you have to be more transhumant or move from place to place more frequently. In the interior, you certainly have to have some kind of sedentary winter settlement, someplace to hold up. It's so cold and so severe. You have to have a large store of food and a place, a good solid shelter to make it through the winter. And the coastal areas here, I think that people could probably be a lot more mobile. Could have larger settlements. I think that the resources were probably more abundant in areas. These intertidal areas, women, children, people of all ages, old people can collect a tremendous amount of food in a very short period of time, possibly not being reliant on younger males to capture the more dangerous or larger animals.
As a rule, archaeologists don't like to discuss the temperament of prehistoric humans. A few stone tools don't offer any more insight into the character of ancient people than stainless steel flatware offers into our character. But it's difficult for Dixon and other archaeologists to state their case without admitting that the coastal people they're looking for would have been more innovative than inland hunters.
I think people were able to do a great many things that we don't give them credit for.
John Autry is an archaeologist with the Forest Service. He thinks early humans may have expressed their resourcefulness by using boats to get around.
If you or I today were to be placed out on an island with what we had with us, we may be hard-pressed to survive comfortably anyway. These people most certainly knew how to utilize the resources, what resources were available. They had the technology to build boats. I think they had the technology to utilize deep water fishing in deep water.
If you don't find a boat, do you think that they were still boat people? Could they have wandered down the coast on foot?
As you've noticed, the coastline is very irregular and very steep and very hard to walk through because of the vegetation and the terrain. Intuitively, I know that I would prefer going by water as opposed to crossing the land. And I also know, in modern kayaks, for instance, it's under the right conditions and the desire to do so, it's not hard to travel 30, 40, or 50 miles in a single day. You would be hard-pressed to go 10 miles in a day overland.
This is amazing. What is the name of this room?
Cathedral Room.
Because it looks like a cathedral.
And the sound in it is like a cathedral.
Does it have an echo?
Oh yeah, hear it?
These caves are ideal places to look for evidence of early peoples coming into the Americas.
Archaeologist James Dixon.
Because the preservation is excellent, it provides a focused place to look, and we need caves that were above sea level at that time. Much of the continental shelf along which people may have camped and lived is now covered by rising sea level, so it's underwater. So these caves provide really a unique window into the prehistoric past, particularly for this time period.
About 250 feet from the entrance of El Capitan Cave, a caver, scuffing up a black shiny rock, found an ancient obsidian blade. Cave paintings, a primitive trash heap of shells, and the skeletal remains of an otter ceremonially wrapped in bark are other signs that these caves have been used by humans for at least 3,000 years. Although that's far too recent to disclose anything about Ice Age humans, John Autry and James Dixon are hoping to find something older. Dixon has proposed a major 10-year study of the caves. Autry and the Forest Service have signed on to provide logistical support. Their goal is to find a trail of evidence that leads back beyond the Ice Age to a new theory of how people entered the continent.
Here I come. Oh my gosh.
We see your feet.
How high do you think this little spot is?
12, 14 inches.
I thought I was wider than that. Wow, it's really a bizarre sensation.
forward than you are. Come in and face forward, though.
You want me to come face forward?
Yeah.
Why?
Because you won't have enough room if you come feet forward right now.
Here she comes. Sounds like an avalanche. Pack first. Mm-hmm. And then her light. There she is. Oh, that was fun.
The cavers are not scientists. They're volunteer explorers. But a rewrite of North American archaeology rides on their enthusiasm for going into dark and difficult places. Caked in mud, laughing about a particularly tight passage they named Fat Man Filter, they are on the front lines, or under them, of a major environmental and scientific battle.
My gosh, there is light out there! See the light of day.
Doesn't everything look so colorful and warm?
It feels hot out here.
The theory that Ice Age mariners lived on this coast has had none of the usual lucky breaks. No child has stumbled upon an ancient stone tool. No backhoe has accidentally unearthed human remains. The rugged terrain makes that kind of discovery unlikely. The theory hangs mostly on the intuition of a growing number of archaeologists who are trying to link the caves on Prince of Wales Island with prehistoric sites in South America and Pennsylvania, which were all settled before the glaciers melted. If Dixon and his colleagues find signs of humans that date to or before the Ice Age, it could explain how and when people migrated onto this continent. We also might learn just how clever North America's earliest inhabitants really were.
What kind of people were they? Archaeologists have different perspectives on prehistoric humans, and I think that one of the oppositions to this kind of coastal route is that I think many archaeologists regard prehistoric humans as rather, if not land lovers, certainly people that were not very adventurous and probably not very capable of dealing with the sea and so forth. I see them as very robust, adventurous, capable people that would cope with a lot of very rough situations that I think many of us today would find very difficult. And I think these people were very wise and very in tune to their environment and certainly could have handled a migration like that or movement along this coast very easily and very early.
Cave People was written and produced by Lisa Bush and Robert Woolsey at the Writer's Block in Sitka, Alaska. The studio engineer was Dave Patchkey. For technical assistance, special thanks to Mary Baker at WCAW-FM in Sitka. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU at the American University. Special thanks to WVPN. Today's program is funded by the National Science Foundation, additional support provided by this and other NPR member stations, and the NPR Information Fund, whose contributors include the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation. Now, a couple of letters from listeners. Norman Holland writes about our recent D-Day program, "I am barely over 40 years old. World War II is usually more a history lesson to me," he writes, "than an arena of battle. Wars are placed in the context of my war, Vietnam. But the sound images in your D-Day piece have been haunting me. I think of the soldier looking back on the bodies piled up on Omaha Beach, and of the man who said it was possible to walk back to the beach on top of the dead without once touching the sand. This is a sound print that has truly imprinted itself on my brain." And Barbara Carr of Seattle, Washington writes, "I heard your report on depression today and found it to be lucid and helpful. The weaving of personal stories with what scientific information we have was particularly effective. So often stories on depression focus on the drama and the horror stories that end in suicide, stories that just make us feel more helpless in dealing with depression. Perhaps with more focus on treating the problem, we could begin to work more rationally and productively with depression. Thank you for the work you did on this. It has already been immensely helpful to me. And she adds, how could I get a tape of the broadcast, and what does it cost? Well, you can write us at Soundprint, 4000 Brandywine Street Northwest, Suite 620, Washington, D.C., 20016. Cassettes are $12.50, and if you want to order with a credit card, you simply call us at 202-885-1285. Again, that's 202-885-1285. On the Internet, our address is soundprint@american.edu. And now, people of Earth, a warning. It's summertime. The fish are jumping, the cotton is high, the humidity is unbearable. August is just around the corner, the time of year when we all leave town. Soundprint is hitting the road, too, next month. First, we take you to the rolling hills of Pennsylvania for a trip through the rubble of a Rust Belt metropolis.
This is the Plaza Restaurant, a hangout for old-timers and assorted characters. There's a lot of history here.
My name is Joe Abbey, former professional wrestler, and now engaged in a repossession services of repossessing automobiles. I do locksmith work, investigations, and that's about it.
I tried to bet and invest every dime I had to revitalize Braddock, but from the lack of cooperation and the pessimistic thinking that permeated some of the businessmen and some of the so-called leaders and politicians of Braddock, I could not get any cooperation. Therefore, the negative thinking that permeated Braddock destroyed it.
That's Braddock, Pennsylvania, city of magic. Next, we're off to Sarajevo, where we join a group of radio journalists trying to report on the war.
An army spokesman will hold a press conference downtown later today, and now the reporters are discussing whether or not one of them should go and ask questions.
I'm afraid it could be dangerous for the whole Radio Zid, because we work for the Radio Zid, and we're not just representing ourselves, we are representing the whole radio, and we have to think about the questions, and we have to consult our chief editor about the questions we are going to ask.
What are you afraid of?
I'm afraid to ask irritating questions because of the obvious situation.
Do you think there could be consequences?
Yes, I'm sure there will be consequences.
Like what?
They could stop the radio from working. They could dismiss all of us.
They could physically beat us, you know, because they have power, they have arms, they have everything.
That's Up Against the War with Radio Z. Then, the last part of August, we fly off to India, where we join a group of women struggling with issues of child marriage, violence, rape, and social identity.
Bhavri had gone to her field along with her husband to get some fodder for the cattle. Three people caught hold of her. These three people got on to Bhavri. They just pushed her down on the ground. And two people kept holding her. They pinned her down, one from the arm side, one from the leg side. And one person in turn committed this heinous rape with her.
What? Rape? In our village, a younger brother won't even sit and smoke with his elder brother out of sheer respect for him. Now three brothers have been accused of committing rape together. How is this possible?
Soundprint is Technical Director Anna Maria de Freitas, Studio Engineer Robin Wise, and Production Assistant Francesca Raymond. Our Executive Producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Larry Massett.